this is how I've been thinking I was going to structure tonight and tomorrow. But that's actually still up in the air a little bit. I try to over-prepare and then play jazz, you know, and try to be as informal as I can. This helps me to be more orderly than I would be naturally, and that's important because some of you, you know, will wonder if I am ever going to land the airplane sometimes, or whatever that might be. So that's there. But so talk one, it says, what is missing in our marriages? Two, getting on a different page together. Talk three, growing together. That was intentional. Spell check wanted me to delete that duplicated word. And I have this little sidebar, just a few minutes about time. I thought that was funny. A few minutes about time. Or thin margins in a busy is better world. If you flip the page, those are my sort of talking notes. And then if you flip another page, I Xeroxed a bunch of pages out of mostly one book. And we're not going to read all that. But, you know, take this with you and you can work through it together. You may end up buying the book. I don't know. On the very last page, I give you the title of the book, Hold Me Tight, Seven Conversations for a Lifetime of Love, Susan Johnson, 2008. The things that Sue Johnson talks about, the approach that she developed with another person named Les Greenberg, as they've done research on the effectiveness of this particular approach to marriage therapy, it is like the best, way past everything else, approach to helping couples. It's unbelievable. One of the things that really stood out to me was when I read that when they did the follow-up research, where they're so couples in counseling for, say, 18 sessions, they give them, and when they came in, they give them a measure of how their marriage is. Then when they finished, they gave another measure, and they'd improved. I think those were scaled like an IQ test. Maybe they came in and they had an 85, you know, not too smart, rarely, not doing too well, and maybe at the end it was like 103. And then they followed up a year later, and it was like 118. And that's unheard of. What counselors do, people like me, do with individuals and couples, tends to have a short shelf life. I mean, it just does, in certain kinds of ways. And this isn't like that at all. And Sue Johnson's not a believer that I know. Pretty sure that she's not. She may have a church background, but that's not where she's coming from in her thinking. But she writes what she's writing about and what she focuses on. It's like really good theology. I mean, she doesn't know that, but it's just better than some of the things that our theologians have written in terms of understanding people. So it's a very, very helpful thing. And so that's why I give you pieces of it. And we will talk and look at some of that even tonight and then tomorrow. In some ways, the missing piece thing is a little bit distracting. Yeah, I got to rearrange the furniture. Thank you. As I've been, I should be clear. I've been working. I started out as a social worker, but it's children, public child welfare. So it was with kids and families. Did that for 8 years. Then I went to school to become a pastor. Did that for a year. And church I went to as an assistant pastor, we were there 6 weeks and the thing fell apart. And I hope it wasn't our fault, but it split and they weren't a two-pastor church anymore. And we eventually headed back to St. Louis. And at that point, had to make a decision about, I wanted to go to graduate school. I wanted to get a doctorate degree. Wasn't sure exactly what in, but counseling made sense. And eventually stumbled on marriage and family and kind of went, why did, I've always been interested in this from way back. And as I started to do more counseling then, back in about 1992, I recognized that I'd always been a sort of a generalist. You know, it's like, work with anybody, you know, whatever issues are. And I was really feeling the weight of how challenging it is to really help somebody through counseling. And so I decided I needed to specialize. So at that point, I said, I'm just going to take couples. And for the most part, that's what I've done for the last 92, 2002, so 20 plus years. Then 8 years ago, I had the opportunity to go to some training in this approach that Sue Johnson uses. And now I've done a PhD, where I took 8 years to do it. You know, that means I kept studying it, and that I'm slow. And marriage and family counseling. And you would think I would like know stuff, and I did like know a lot of stuff, but almost too much stuff. And I hadn't really realized I needed to make some decisions on what are the key things you need to look at. By the way, it's a little bit of a sidebar. I think we've made the same mistake in the church. We tend, you know, we teach all this wonderful theology, and it is wonderful. But we sort of teach it as equal. And there are a few things that we need to kind of go, whoa, wait a minute, let's hold this up high and really focus on this. And so when I did this training 8 years ago, with someone who has worked with Sue Johnson, a Christian guy, teaches at Fuller Seminary. The impact on me was all this stuff I've learned sort of got pushed off to the edges of the stage. Still context, it still made sense, it's still helpful to understand things, but in terms of what to do with people, not so much. And this approach that Sue Johnson was talking about was like, oh, this is it. This really makes a lot of sense. And since then, there's been this circular process of thinking about people, thinking about what God says about people, thinking about both of those things in light of the other, and sort of continuing in that circular process as I work with people and try to get better at this process. So I'll start with this piece of that circle. It's always hard to know where to start in the circle. And this question, what's the bottom line of the gospel? What's the main thing God was trying to accomplish through the work of Christ, the death and resurrection of Christ? Now, the way you answer that, by the way, has a lot to do with how you think about people and how you think about God. And it has a lot to do with what we've been taught. I grew up in the church all my life. My father was a pastor, and I just never went through those rebellious times that some of my friends did. Had my struggles, but just all my life I've been in the church. My mother worked at a Christian college. I mean, I've been in ministry settings all my life in all kinds of ways. And what I learned was something like, well, the gospel, Christ's work, is about forgiveness of sins, paying the penalty for our sins, which the theologians would say justification. That's not wrong. You know, that would be a bad misunderstanding. But it's missing something. Something really big, it seems to me. And if you go back, think, sort of rethink the story, Genesis 1 and 2. I mean, the very first verse, in the beginning, God created. And if you think about the context of when this is being told, yeah, I did limp a couple of times there. On that flight for 4 hours, I couldn't move that leg. You know, I just didn't have, and there was a very large person sitting next to me here. He or she had the arm up because they couldn't fit in the chair with the arm down. And she was in my seat, and I said, see, and hers, and I couldn't move my legs, and so it's hurting now. So anyway, that God, through Moses, is writing for Israel. He's saying, okay, you've been in slavery 400 years. All those gods, that's been your culture. You absorb the things of the culture that you live in. I want to tell you the truth. How does he say it? He starts out, in the beginning, God. There's only one in this story. It's the only one that counts. God created the heavens and the earth. But he's doing that by speaking it, by telling the story, by entering into their lives. So my friend Mike Williams that I get to teach with now these days will draw a line and he'll put God and then everything else, including us, below the line. And he's transcendent, but, and he'll draw an arrow. He entered into our space, so he's immanent also. So he's other, but he relates to us. And the two fit together. The fact that he's other is required in order to be relationship. So God says, in the beginning, God. God's the subject there. Yeah? Subjects are persons, people, places, or things. He's not a thing. He's not a place. He's a person. God's saying, I'm a person. We get a little further in the story, and he says, I'm making you to reflect me. You're an image bearer. You reflect me. It's because you're a person too. What was God saying? Persons relate, and persons act. He can come up with a few other things if you work hard, but you don't really need them. So about a year ago, I heard Mike Williams say this sentence. Persons are constituted in relationships. Now you have to think about that one for a good long time to really take it in and make a decision whether you're going to embrace that or not. But Mike is saying, and I agree with him, that the Bible's telling us, God's telling us through the way he tells the story, that he made you to be a person, but to really be a person, to become into your fullness as a person, you need to be in relationships. That's the reason that in Genesis 2:18, what does God say? It's not good for man to be alone. And so he gives Adam work to do, name those animals, which, by the way, are not alone. You know, there's Mr. and Mrs. Squirrel, or whatever. And at the end of that exercise, it says, but a suitable helper was not found for Adam. God already knew that. You know, that wasn't a description of what God discovered. That was a description of what Adam discovered, what God taught Adam. Adam, you need to understand. You need a relationship to really be who I made you to be. You need one like you, but different. One who's an other, but who's with. Which is why when God creates Eve and brings her to Adam, Adam basically says, wow, finally, one who's bone of my bone, one who's like me. I'm not alone anymore. I'm not alone anymore. That Adam can be more Adam. because there's Eve. Without relationship, we just really are less than what God has made us to be. I don't have to tell you how to, you know, to think about that in relationship to your marriage. It's fascinating to me that people who study this, there's a man who wrote a book called Self Within Marriage. He's the head of the psychoanalytic, you know, the Freudian people, psychoanalytic institute in Kansas City, Missouri. I don't know if that's a big thing or not. I mean, I kind of think, you know, cowboys come from Kansas City, not Freudian psychoanalysts, but there you have it. But he wrote this wonderful book where he's just saying the thrust of his book, and it's tricky for people to understand, but the thrust of his book is, if you're in a good marriage and you're really developing couplehood, being a couple, both people become stronger, fuller people. It's kind of ironic, in a sense. The more you can be connected, the stronger you are as an individual. Fascinating. Well, shouldn't surprise us. It's the way God set it up. That guy's just looking around and he's seeing something that God set it up this way. When I see good marriages, I see stronger people. I see people on the grow. So, but you know the story. So Adam and Eve, you know, God has said, don't eat fruit of that tree, but they do. God comes looking for them. Where are you? Because they're hiding, because they know now that they're naked and they're ashamed. The opposite of what Genesis 2, 24, 25 tell us, that they were naked without shame. And God comes, challenges, and in that context, Adam says, it was the woman you gave me. He's like double finger pointing. Try to weasel out. You got to give him credit. Eventually he did get to the, I ate it. But after the fact of, I want to protect myself. I want to protect myself. I'm going to talk tomorrow more about just the nature of what that looks like by telling a story about Scott and Missy. But I think I'll hold that for tomorrow. And the thing that we see there is understanding what was going on there helps us understand what is the missing piece in so many of our marriages. The missing piece that makes it really hard. And it is. And I'm actually convinced that it's every single marriage because they happen to be made up of human beings. And we're all sons and daughters of Adam. And at some point, when push comes to shove, we're going to defend ourselves or protect ourselves. And we're not too concerned with the cost of somebody else at that moment. And I think a big chunk of the purpose of the gospel was to turn that tendency to grow us as people so that we would actually love others enough so that there'd be a chance, growing chance, that we're not just going to try to escape and protect ourselves. But rather we'll be honest. And in that honest context with each other, that we actually build a different kind of relationship. So I think the gospel is about restoring relationships with God, restoring relationships with other people, and restoring relationships with ourselves. Because if we're going to have that kind of relationship, you got to figure yourself out a little bit better. You got to be able to be aware of what's going on inside you. Because the things you're not aware of are the things that actually drive you into the behaviors that you get messed up with each other. There are probably lots of labels I could put to this missing piece, but maybe that's the clearest. The missing piece is that awareness to actually regulate ourselves so that we relate with each other more honestly rather than defensively. And here's the biggest payoff. And we relate to the other for their good rather than for our safety. You can think about it some more, but if you think about, so Jesus is challenged on what's the greatest commandment? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, strength. And another like it, love your neighbor as yourself. He just addressed the three relationships. And on that page there, I gave you Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. I don't have it all memorized, so I better pick it up myself. Where Paul also gives a summary to the relation of to the gospel, and he addresses those same three relationships. Right in the middle of the page there, sort of, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children. That's two relationships. And walk in love. That's the third. As Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Be imitators of God. You model after, you imitate people that you know well enough and love enough and admire enough that you want to be like them. Paul's saying, that's what your discipleship should result in. That's what your walk, that's what your prayer, that's what your walk with God should result in. The kind of depth of relationship that you want, you end up feeling like, I want to be like God. That we walk in love with each other. But then there's that middle one, as beloved children. As beloved children. I think what Paul's saying there is, God wants you to look at yourself the way he looks at you as a beloved child. In a very real sense, this is a connecting point between what Sue Johnson writes and what Paul writes right there. Because in essence, what Sue Johnson is saying is the thing that's crucial in our marriages is that each spouse, that I'm, my wife Carol Ann, that with Carol Ann, I have enough assurance that we're connected, that I trust her, that she's safe, that she's accessible to me, that she's responsive to me, because we have that connection, that we're engaged with each other, that I count, like more than anybody. Kind of like a beloved child, except I'm not a child, but I'm beloved by her. And to experience that enough with her that I actually see myself that way in relationship with her. And she sees herself that way in relationship with me because she knows she's my beloved. Now, Sue Johnson will put it in, talk about attachment and emotions and attachment injuries and things like that, but it's all revolving around that idea of, can you have enough conversation with each other, not all of them, but enough conversation with each other where the conversation is actually about the stuff underneath that's the most important stuff. That's really about questions like, how much do I count with you? When you're arguing about, you know, one of those annoying things. I mentioned to Jonathan and Karen that I did a conference like this a couple of years ago in Hawaii, and that pastor, associate pastor rather, one of his elders was at the seminary this week, and the elder was saying, He was a really nice guy, and it was really encouraging things that he was saying. But he basically, what he was saying was, well, you know, you said a lot of stuff, and I don't remember any of that. But I remember this one little thing you said. And that was really helpful for me. And that was helpful, encouraging for me, too, because that's the way it works. I have no idea what's going to be helpful for each individual person and couple. God has to do something with that. But it was this thing that he talked about. It's the idea of, anybody in here ever argue over the dishwasher? I have more than one couple do that. I mean, it happens, you know. It's just, you wouldn't think, but it happens. And A couple I'm thinking of that I, some years back, was meeting with. She was very determined to run the dishwasher every night. You know, so that the dishes could wash while they were asleep and they'd be done, get up in the morning, put them away, and start her day with a clean dishwasher. And as the dishes are dirty, she can put them in there. And her husband was very determined that they not waste that much water and detergent by doing loads that are only half full. So he wanted her to wait to whenever it was that it was full. And they just were going round and round and round about that and had for a long time and never resolved anything. And now they're, you know, they're coming in to see me. And it's like, now they're doing it here. It's like, first of all, it's probably an unsolvable problem. There are problems that you just can't solve. And it's just the way that it is. But in our discussion, what we tried to get at is, why is this important to you? And what it came down to was, in a little different way, but for both of them, it was, I don't think she cares what I say, and I don't think he cares what I need. I don't think he cares about me. He cares about himself more than me. And that argument over the dishwasher was creating division. When actually, you know, any night that she ran the dishwasher and it wasn't full, more division. There she goes again. She's not listening to me. She knows what I want. Or she waits until it's full and she runs it. He doesn't say anything. More division. It doesn't really matter. Or he got his way, so he's not saying anything. Or whatever it is. They're not. It's not pulling them together at that point. Because they hadn't talked enough about, why is this important to you? They hadn't talked enough about, what do you need? What do you want? What's happening here? Help me understand your heart. So that their conversations, they weren't really having a heart-to-heart conversation or a heart-to-heart relationship. And they were growing disconnection in the process. It's that connection that we can do it the other way and build connection through the conversation. And it's that connection that ends up being the missing piece. And here's the problem. You have literally thousands of opportunities for that kind of disconnection. And you don't have to have great big issues. It can just be little stuff, how you squeeze the toothpaste. He won't listen to me. It's important to me, but he won't do it. And it's an assault on your connection. And you add that up and it erodes that connection. And I started saying this in a different way a long time ago. It was the awareness of, it didn't matter how serious the issue was that people were coming in for counseling about. The main issue actually was that they hadn't become a couple. Well, the not connected, not getting heart to heart is a clearer way, I think, of saying the issue was that they hadn't really become. Let's flip the page here and see what Sue says about a couple of these things here. I'm just going to look at page 31. Start there I have a little bracket around on the right margin. We are swamped by what neuroscientist Jacques Pankstep of Washington State University calls primal panic. Then we generally do one of two things. This is the point. We either become demanding and clingy in an effort to draw comfort and reassurance from our partner, or we withdraw and detach in an attempt to soothe and protect ourselves. No matter the exact words, what we're really saying in these reactions is, notice me, be with me, I need you, or I won't let you hurt me. I will chill out, try to stay in control. very few of us are actually tuned into ourselves enough to know that that's actually what's going on. We're just upset because they did that thing, and we know why we're mad at them. And those conversations, you know, one of the ways, common way, is it ends up being, I know what you did wrong, you need to listen to me, you need to straighten out your behavior, we need to correct your misbehavior. If we get you correct your misbehavior, our marriage will be great. I don't know if anybody's actually been able to do it. It would be strange. It can happen, but it would be unusual. Because when one spouse is pointing, saying, we have to fix your misbehavior, that other spouse, pretty much if they're alive, they have to protect themselves. They're going to defend themselves. No, it's not my fault. And they're at least partly right about that. Because it's this relationship dance that we're actually in. There's an underline, just drop down. I'll start with the beginning of the paragraph. If we love our partners, why do we not just hear each other's calls for attention and connection and respond with caring? Because much of the time we're not tuned in to our partners. I think that's a relational skill that has been lost. And we've been working at losing it for centuries. Actually tuning in. In the New York Times, of a post, a blog, I think it is, on related to love. Recently, an author wrote about research that was done 15 or 20 years ago, where a researcher developed a way he believed that he could cause people to fall in love with each other. 36 questions, and what the questions are actually doesn't matter. It's more the process that he set up. I think that's my theory. But, you know, interesting questions that start pretty light and get deeper. And there are things like, this might not be one of the questions, but of this nature of, so if your house was burning down, what would you take out with you? What was most valuable to you? Things like that. And they're going back and forth. I remember, you know, so the other people are like listening. It's very powerful. And at the end of it, there's this exercise. Look into each other's eyes for 4 minutes. You can't look away, and you can't talk. That's weird. I mean, can you do like 10 seconds? That's like an intimacy it's too much. But they were told to do it that way. The researcher said this is what you're supposed to do. The author writing, you know, somewhere in the last few months, decided she was going to try it out on a friend of hers. And at the end, she's like, yeah, I think we fell in love. I don't know if that's what really happened. I think it's a slice. Personally, I think it's you got connected. You got connected by sharing things and have someone else actually, rather than critique, respond. Listen. Or not respond. Or respond non-verbally. That can be very, very powerful. And, I had a verbal part there. I'm a terrible actor. And then the looking into each other's eyes, there's something of a... I have to say, we all have a certain amount of, you know, we know where our personal space starts. And if I keep going and I keep invading it, you know, something, we're both getting uncomfortable, actually. But that's a that's a kind of pressure. But if we can maintain that pressure in a way that's benevolent and you relax in it, now you're building connection.